Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 28, 2003. I'm Deepa Fernandez. The majority of the nearly $2 billion that Halliburton receives in Iraq contracts won't be going to improve conditions of the Iraqi people. John Ashcroft hits Idaho this week to sell his Patriot Act. And Jordanian farmers are suffering as harsh water-saving mechanisms imposed under IMF measures are threatening their livelihoods. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Jesse Jackson spoke at a union rally for striking workers at Yale University, offering his support and remembering the 1963 March on Washington. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
Workers marched through the streets to the medical school. Jackson tied the struggle of the 4,000 Yale workers to the fight against slavery and for workers' rights throughout American history. He also mentioned the loss of millions of jobs under the Bush administration and exhorted people to make a regime change at home in 2004.
I said in closing, I know Dr. King would be happy today. Look out in this audience today, there are many symbolic activities commemorating 40 years ago. He would not have been satisfied with analysis. He would want action.
Jackson met yesterday with Yale President Rick Levin on behalf of Locals 34 and 35 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union in an effort to help resolve the strike. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
President Bush cited a national emergency as his reason for limiting raises for 1.2 million government employees to just 2%. John Hamilton with the Workers' Independent News Service has more.
It's the latest blow for federal civilian workers, many of whom have already been stripped of their collective bargaining rights by the White House.
Federal employees are working class people by and large, and that extra money in their pocket is something they really need to put food on the table and buy clothes for their kids to go back to school and pay their mortgages and their car payments and what have you.
Jackie Simon is public policy director for the American Federation of Government Employees, the largest union of federal workers. She's worried not only about Bush's proposal to roll back pay raises, but also his proposal to set aside $500 million for a pay-for-performance system.
He's trying to create this slush fund with $500 million in it that will allow political appointees to hand out additional raises and bonuses to anybody they think is doing a good job with the president's political agenda.
A similar bid to roll back government employee raises last year was defeated in Congress. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
Workers at Shell Petroleum are on strike in Nigeria to protest a new program they believe is designed to replace indigenous workers with foreigners. Sam Olakoya has more from Lagos.
The workers said in the last 7 years, the oil company had implemented several programs for this same purpose. The protesting workers described the management of Shell Petroleum as agents of globalization. Nigeria's National Oil Workers Union is backing the Shell workers. The union says if Shell succeeds with its globalization plan, other foreign oil companies operating in Nigeria will adopt a similar program. Shell Petroleum accounts for about half of the 2 million barrels of crude oil exported daily from Nigeria. The strike could affect oil exports from Nigeria, the world's sixth largest oil producer. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
A government lab in India has confirmed the presence of pesticides in Coca-Cola and Pepsi products sold in that country. Vinod K. Jose reports.
The Government Research Institute today revealed that the soft drink samples from Pepsi and Coke contain much higher levels of pesticide, including lindane and DDT, both known to cause cancer and serious birth defects, than permissible under the European Union norms. The central government had to order a test in its laboratory 3 weeks back after a controversy broke out when an NGO report revealed the presence of high-level toxic in Coca-Cola and Pepsi sold in India. The government study controlled by Central Food Laboratory said pesticide lindane was present in all the soft drinks that were tested and was higher by 1.4 times the European norms. Another pesticide, chlorpyrifos, was also present in all the samples, the report said. But whether the government would initiate any action against the American multinational companies selling toxic drinks is still just in the wait-and-see stage. From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Washington Post gained the attention of the nation today with a front-page story showing that Halliburton, the company formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, has been awarded over $1.7 billion under the Pentagon's Operation Iraqi Freedom. Halliburton is also poised to receive hundreds of millions of dollars in no-bid contracts from the U.S. Army during the upcoming months. The Post reported that a third of the $3.9 billion a month that the U.S. spends in Iraq goes to private corporations that have close ties to the Bush administration, which along with Halliburton includes Bechtel, whose president at one time was former Secretary of State George Shultz. And as Mitch Jeserich reports, the majority of money that Halliburton receives won't be going to improve conditions of the Iraqi people, but to build the infrastructure to meet the needs of the U.S. military.
Though the Washington Post reported it on Wednesday, anti-war demonstrators have known for months that the invasion of Iraq would result in billions of dollars for private corporations that have close ties to the Bush administration. Still, the Washington Post rendered some interesting numbers which show that a Halliburton subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, has received almost $1 billion, in which only 17% goes to the Iraqi reconstruction effort. The rest goes towards supporting the military. Protop Chatterjee is the managing editor of the online publication Corp Watch.
Some of the money is spent on maintaining enemy prisoner of war camps. Some of it is spent on housing and transport for U.S. troops. And then finally, another big chunk of money is spent on logistical support for teams investigating the mythical Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. So $40 million in that alone goes directly to Halliburton. So they're making a profit out of this mythical search for weapons of mass destruction.
As a whole, Halliburton has received at least $1.7 billion for its work in Iraq, which is much larger than originally disclosed. Halliburton received the contract through a no-bid process, which simply means no other companies competed against it for the job. Chatterjee says the simple fact that Vice President Dick Cheney used to head Halliburton should not be taken lightly.
Halliburton continues to pay Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United States of America, $180,000 a year in compensation for work done previously. It's a tax dodge by which he gets money for work he did in the past and gets a check every single year. Now, whereas a lot of people want to save on taxes, I think the very fact that this man is spending our tax dollars to send soldiers into Iraq, invade a country and kill people, and refuse to pay his own taxes is a complete disgrace. It may be legal, but so is slavery.
A spokesperson for Halliburton, Wendy Hall, did not return phone calls, but she did respond to an email by Free Speech Radio News in which she wrote that it's easier to assign devious motives than to take time to learn the truth. She wrote that the contract is a continuation of a program established in 1992 by the U.S. Army. She continued that Cheney was not involved in the awarding of the defense contracts, and to suggest that Halliburton advocates war is an affront on its employees. Still, Tyson Slocum with Public Citizen says it's a handful of companies with strong ties to the Bush administration that are reaping large profits off the invasion.
For some reason, the Bush administration suspended the competitive bid process for war contracts in Iraq. Now, they did the same thing in Afghanistan, but there it was a rational decision to suspend the uncompetitive bid process because the war was organized in a very short amount of time. However, the buildup to Iraq took nearly 10 months, and that is more than enough time for the federal government to begin its competitive procurement process.
Both Halliburton and Bechtel are expected to receive greater contracts for Iraqi reconstruction work. The Wall Street Journal reported that Bechtel is slated to receive $350 million in contracts, a 50% jump from previous contracts awarded. The United States is still soliciting other nations to send their troops to Iraq to help quash the American resistance. Many countries are hesitant, though, to do so without a UN mandate. Reports indicate the U.S. is considering giving the U.N. a larger role in the reconstruction process. However, the no-bid contract awarded to American corporations could become a stumbling block in the negotiations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Attorney General John Ashcroft's Patriot Act tour came to Boise this week near the home of Butch Otter, the Republican congressman who's led the charge in the House for repealing parts of the act. Critics believe by bringing the debate to Idaho, Ashcroft is targeting Otter. Otter's bill prohibiting warrantless sneak and peek searches passed the House 309 to 118. Ashcroft's tour so far has hit Philadelphia, Cleveland, Detroit, and Des Moines. If it's successful, it may lead to the introduction of Senator Orrin Hatch's so-called Victory Act this fall, which contains many of the provisions found in the leaked version of the Second Patriot Act. Lee Robartis has more from Idaho.
I need my dad to come back.
The children of Sami al-Hussein have not seen their father since February, when the University of Idaho doctoral student from Saudi Arabia was arrested for visa violations. Federal prosecutors say he has terrorist ties, but friends who held giant photos of al-Hussein at a Patriot Act forum in Moscow, Idaho, say he's innocent.
He did nothing. I'm sure about that.
Saudi student Nabil Al-Balushi, a friend of al-Hussein's who has lived here for 9 years, says his children also miss Sami.
They work very hard to keep him in jail, even though the judge he ordered to release him.
The star of the forum was Butch Otter, one of the few Republicans in Congress to vote against the act.
I would just like for us to recover our senses for a little bit and in the calm of this day, do the right thing. And the right thing would be to take back that broad expansion of authorities that we gave not to just the FBI, the CIA, and the National Security Agency, but to 77 federal agencies.
By not towing the line, Otter earned the scorn of fellow Republican John Ashcroft. Ashcroft's Justice Department called Otter's legislation prohibiting funding for sneak and peek or warrantless searches without notification the terrorist tip-off amendment.
We have used the tools provided in the Patriot Act to fulfill our first responsibility to protect the American people. We have used these tools to prevent terrorists from unleashing more death and destruction on our soil.
As has been his custom on the tour, Ashcroft spoke in Boise to a group of invited law enforcement officers and press. This prompted the 100 protesters outside to wonder if the attorney general is afraid of dialogue.
Were it not for Otter's opposition to Patriot, Boise would have never registered on Ashcroft's Richter scale.
University of Idaho law professor Liz Brandt, member of the National ACLU Board of Directors, says the main problem with the Patriot Act is it lowers the standard for using special surveillance available to the intelligence community under the Foreign Intelligence and Security Act.
Prior to Patriot, you had to show that gathering intelligence was a primary purpose of the investigation to use those powers. After Patriot, you have to only show that it's a significant purpose to use those powers. And the sneak and peek searches and the data searches under the library stuff under Section 215 all flow from that.
But draft legislation circulated by Orrin Hatch may tear down the wall farther. Senator Hatch's Victory Act, which seeks to define drug trafficking as a terrorist activity, also incorporates some aspects of the despised Patriot Act II, also known as the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, that was stillborn after drafts were leaked. Attorney Jeff Fogel of the Center for Constitutional Rights finds two aspects of Hatch's draft frightening. One requires courts to admit illegal searches into evidence unless it can be proved officers acted in bad faith, and the other giving law enforcement subpoena power.
We have always taken the position in our history in the United States that the only two sources of subpoenas in the criminal law area, one is by a judge and the other is by a grand jury. And the notion is that we did not want to give law enforcement the authority to require people to appear before them and answer questions or to seize records without some kind of oversight.
Congressional observers believe Hatch's Victory Act may be introduced in September. Meanwhile, no companion to Otter's Sneak and Peek Amendment has been introduced in the Senate so far. Representative Bernie Sanders' Freedom to Read Act, repealing Patriot Act surveillance tools targeting libraries and bookstores, now has 113 co-sponsors in the House. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
Israeli forces rolled into northern Gaza today with a bulldozer and 10 armored personnel carriers after a Qassam rocket was launched from inside the territory and landed near Ashkelon. Israel says it's the northernmost point a Qassam rocket has reached from Gaza. Shortly after the rocket launch, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon ordered the Israeli military to, quote, take all necessary steps against those he describes as militants. Earlier in the day, in a move welcomed by some in the Israeli government, the Palestinian Authority called on all Palestinian banks to put, quote, a preemptive freeze on the assets of six Islamic charities and NGOs throughout the Gaza Strip, saying at least two of the charities may be fronts for the military wing of Hamas. The move to freeze assets prompted protests throughout the Gaza Strip. In Gaza City, some 2,000 Palestinians protested, calling Abbas, quote, an American agent. When they arrived at various welfare offices, only to discover much-needed aid will not be offered. Wad Dwabes has more from Ramallah on the political moves of Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas.
In an emergency meeting, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas met with his cabinet in Gaza Wednesday and is slated to meet with some of the Palestinian factions to convince them to return to the true ceasefire or Hudna. These factions, mainly Hamas and Islamic Jihad, are calling for an Israeli commitment to the ceasefire and not a unilateral true ceasefire to be honored only by Palestinians. But Israeli officials already refused a Palestinian call for a mutual ceasefire and has carried out three extrajudicial assassinations in the Gaza Strip over the past 6 days, which have killed 9 Palestinians and injured more than 30. Ahmad Subuh, Palestinian Deputy Minister of Information, said the intervention of a third party other than the United States is necessary.
The Prime Minister is in Gaza trying to reactivate the Palestinian internal dialogue among the Palestinian groups, factions and parties in order to reestablish this Hudna once again, asking for the clear intervention of third parties, especially the Quartet and the United States, in order to persuade the Israelis to respect the Hudna and to return back to the negotiation table and to the political track.
Palestinian President Yasser Arafat called all Palestinian factions yesterday to return to the Hudna and to stop military acts, an appeal that was dismissed by both Israeli and American officials. The Israeli government is demanding the elimination of Arafat's power and the dismantling of Palestinian factions. All of these demands combined, says Hani al-Masri, a political analyst, will leave Palestinians vulnerable.
The main question is, are we responding with the pressure and dismantling the resistance before going to negotiations? Now, without even knowing where these negotiations will lead? I think that the Palestinian people and the institution will say no, after differences and a lot of discussions, because the resistance is the only arm that the Palestinian people and any other people under occupation have. Without this arm, we shall enter the negotiations barehanded, and negotiations will be controlled by the strongest party, who is Israel, and Israel shall, in this case, impose its own will.
But a new conflict arose between Palestinian President Arafat and his Prime Minister Abbas over the control of the Palestinian security services. Abbas is demanding a full control over all security services in the Palestinian Authority, and Arafat says sticking to the Palestinian Basic Law defining the authorities of both President and the Prime Minister. Still, the Palestinian Authority insists that the conflict between Arafat and Abbas is a constitutional one. Again, Palestinian Deputy Minister of Information Ahmad Subah.
Insisting in the potential or the allegation that there is a conflict between President Arafat and Prime Minister Abu Mazen is a pretext for the Israelis not to implement their own commitments. We recognize, in fact, that we are in a real change on our political system, but without a clear differences between the president and the prime minister, what is going on, how is the Palestinian approach in the negotiation and the daily treatment with the Israeli side, more than any substantial difference.
and the Palestinian population is following the events while supporting the role of Yasser Arafat in negotiations. On Wednesday, Palestinians demonstrated in Ramallah, accusing Abbas of betraying the Palestinian cause and calling him an American agent. The same slogans were raised in Gaza City after the last Israeli assassination attempt of a Hamas leader last Tuesday. Badar, who works for a Palestinian women's magazine, has no trust in Israeli negotiations, but at the same time firmly believes Palestinian resistance must be peaceful.
I didn't believe in Hudna. I think Israeli policy is gonna finish it as soon as possible.
Abbas is trying to win the power struggle battle through legal channels. His government asked the Palestinian Legislative Council to hold a session in the coming days to evaluate the government plan for his first 100 days in office. From Ramallah in the Palestinian occupied territories, I'm Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Massive street demonstrations have rocked the Honduran capital of Tegucigalpa over the last few days as tens of thousands protest economic reforms the government is making, they say, to impress the International Monetary Fund. Honduras's Congress last week passed a law allowing private companies to buy concessions in the state water sector and is planning a law to regulate the salaries of some 100,000 public sector employees in the poor Central American nation. Honduras's president, Ricardo Maduro, says the measures will persuade the IMF to go ahead with a new credit line for Honduras that's been on hold since November. 80% of Honduras's 6.5 million people live in poverty. Meanwhile, in Jordan, the Farmers' Union has threatened to launch nationwide strikes to pressure the government to retract harsh water-saving mechanisms that are threatening the lives of farmers. The prices of vegetables have sharply decreased and many are quitting the profession because of the lack of marketing strategies. And as Ula Farawati reports from the Jordanian Valley that borders Israel, a whole segment of society is being threatened by the IMF-imposed economic policies.
Ahmed Abu Swalem drives the tractor very early every day to go to his farm, a place that fed him and his ancestors for ages. The profession he inherited from his father and grandfather is, as he puts it, all he can do. A farmer for 10 years now, Abu Swalem says he's afraid that he might have to sell the farm and open a shop instead, if life does not show him a brighter face.
Things are only getting worse. I don't know if I will carry on cultivating this land I inherited from my father anymore. Maybe I would be better off if I sell it and open a shop.
Abu Swalem's story tells the plight of farmers in Jordan, a country in which agriculture once was the profession of more than 50% of the population. Now, government statistics say only 6% of Jordanians are farmers, and the country is depending on importing vegetables and fruits from neighboring countries.
We have no water, and they keep preventing us from planting some crops. The ones we cultivate don't sell, and we don't even know how to market them. I don't know what to do. And if I quit this job, my children will starve.
According to former Lower House Deputy Salam Ihyari, the International Monetary Fund's policies that are adopted by Jordan are the ultimate reason behind the suffering of the farmers' community in Jordan.
The International Monetary Fund erroneously advised Jordan to lessen its dependence on locally grown foodstuffs for the sake of saving water. The government numbers that say only 6% of Jordanians are anything but true. Independent figures show that more than 30% of Jordanians work one way or another in the farming field. But the government wants to keep lying and hide the facts, perpetuating its brainless policies.
Jordan approached the International Monetary Fund in the early 90s to carry out an economic revision program that stipulated lessening the consumption of irrigation water. But Ihyari, a former head of the Lower House's Agricultural Committee, believes that rather political reasons stand behind the IMF-crafted Jordan agricultural policies.
It is all about Israel and water. They want to save water here so agriculture flourishes there. Jordan never got its fair share of water, as stipulated in the peace treaty, and they used the IMF to pressure us. And look who is losing.
A strike by the union is expected very soon. It will be the first. But observers expect that it would be repeated many times if the farmers' conditions deteriorate further. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ola Farawati in the Jordan Valley.
State officials in Florida are preparing for the execution next week of a man convicted of killing a doctor who performed abortions and his security escort. This is the first execution in the country for the murder of an abortion doctor. The pending event has become a lightning rod for anti-abortion and anti-death penalty activists who say they're afraid the execution will result in more violence. From St. Petersburg, Sally Watt reports.
Paul Hill is scheduled to die by lethal injection September 3rd for the shotgun shootings of Pensacola abortion doctor John Britton and his security guard, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel James Barrett. The two men were killed outside what was then known as the Ladies' Center in July 1994. Hill represented himself at trial, made only brief opening and closing remarks, and didn't call any witnesses. Hill has always said he wants to die for the anti-abortion cause, and he's encouraged his followers to carry on after his death. Mark Kamleiter, co-chair of the Florida Greens Party, is against the death penalty and says in this case the government is playing right into Hill's hands.
I'm very concerned. I think that this is what he intended to do, to be a martyr. And in a sense, he's manipulating society. He's trying to force society to make him something he would never have been if our society wasn't prepared to execute him. I'd love us to take that away from him, not let him die for the cause.
It's an unusual alliance that's joining forces to try to stop the execution, anti-abortion and anti-death penalty activists and the stepdaughter of one of the victims. They're asking Florida Governor Jeb Bush to commute Hill's sentence to life in prison without chance of parole. The likelihood of more violence became evident when four death threat letters, each containing a bullet, arrived last week in the offices of Florida Attorney General, a judge, and two prison officials. The FBI and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement are investigating the letters. Troy Newman represents Operation Rescue West. He says most people don't realize the intensity of Hill's opinions.
We have to understand the deeply held beliefs of Mr. Hill. And that's that he believes, along with many, many others, that abortion is really killing an innocent human being, that he was, in fact, preventing a murder.
That's the justifiable homicide defense that Hill and a few supporters post on his website. Mainstream anti-abortion advocates say they've distanced themselves from Hill over the years. They estimate 10% of the pro-life movement supports Hill and his philosophy of justifiable homicide. Hill reminds his followers that he was following in the footsteps of Michael Griffin, who killed another Pensacola abortion provider, Dr. David Gunn, in 1993. Abe Bonowitz, president of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, says this could be a never-ending story.
The case of Paul Hill demonstrates how the death penalty truly continues the cycle of violence. Hill deplores what he sees as the violence of abortion and reacts to it by use of violence. Now the state of Florida will use violence against Hill, playing into his hands and thus encouraging anti-abortion extremists to respond to Hill's execution with more violence.
Calling on the governor to commute Hill's sentence is the only action that's being taken. Hill doesn't have an attorney, doesn't want one, and wants to die. He's what's known on death row as a volunteer. The calls for commutation are falling on deaf ears. Governor Bush says he thoroughly reviewed Hill's case before signing the death warrant and that as governor, he's enforcing the law. Again, Greens Party co-chair Mark Kamleiter.
The governor cannot distance himself from the responsibility he has over the executions of people in this state. We didn't put all power in the hands of a judge and a jury. We have established a system of laws that makes the governor the last voice, the last decision maker.
Women's clinics around the country are stepping up security in anticipation of the execution, September 3rd, especially in Pensacola at the Community Health Care Center where the killings took place 7 years ago. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.